Good evening and welcome to Radio Edu Talk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay in Fife, and I'm delighted to welcome for a brief show this evening Professor Adam Hart of the University of Gloucestershire, and we're just going to be talking about the RSB Flying Ant Survey. That's the Royal Society of Biology. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Oh, thank you.
So, just before we talk about the Flying Ant Survey, could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I kind of started life as an entomologist, so I was did a PhD in ants, mostly in ant kind of corporations, how they kind of work together, things like leaf-cutting ants. But I had a little look at some honeybees and some what they call stingless bees, which are fantastic groups of bees that live down in the tropics. Then I started looking at conflict in ants, and recently I've kind of moved away from that. I'm actually Professor of Science Communication now, so I do lots of other bits and pieces, but I've always kept an interest in ants, and actually the flying ants, they were something that we started 3 years ago now, or 3 summers ago, to try and get to the bottom of one of these of this fantastic kind of emergence that happens every summer that it turns out we don't actually know that much about in terms of how coordinated it is and how synchronized it is.
And so how does the ant survey work? Is this something that you're looking for primary schools, primary children to get involved in, or is it something that families can also join in?
It's really something for everyone. It's been running over the last few years. This year we've run it slightly differently in that we had a social media campaign, so people were sending in photographs. But in previous years, anyone can log on. If you go to the Royal Society of Biology's website and you look for the Flying Ant Survey, it's under the Get Involved, and down the left-hand side of the screen you'll see it. You can fill in the details about where and when you've seen your emergence, and that goes into our database. And over the last 3-4 years, we've collected tens of thousands of data points, actually, and we're just analysing those and writing them up now. It's fascinating, actually, the patterns that have appeared over the last few years, and it's very linked to weather. But it's also linked to factors like, well, I guess they're linked to weather, but atmospheric pressure, for example, wind. And what we've done is compared the emergence times and the dates with a whole load of weather parameters that we can get from the Met Office and various other things, and come up with quite a powerful model for predicting as and when they might be coming out. And what we've found is that they're not quite as synchronized as people think. If you look in the textbooks, it's, oh, and in one place they all come out at once, and that's it for the year, and that's not really true. It seems that you can get multiple emergencies. You can get emergencies in the same garden separated by a couple of weeks. It really comes down to the local environment, the sort of local weather, mixed with presumably some sort of internal factors to do with the colony, for example, how developed it is and how many queens and males they've got ready to come out. So it's a sort of complex picture, but at the same time we've managed to show quite a simple picture in that they are responding to local weather, and they are very, very good at it. They seem to be extremely good at predicting the weather, better than we are in some cases.
And in terms of kind of selling the idea to individual young people or whole classes, you know, is it just good fun, or is there a more serious side to, you know, they're contributing to the wealth of human knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, it's always fun to watch ants, and it's always fun to get involved with the natural world. But in terms of contributing to knowledge, well, what's really interesting about this is that we've always known about flying ants. You know, I can imagine back in caveman times, you know, people noticed that ants came out once or twice a year. And if you read through the literature and you go back even sort of 100, 200 years ago in the literature, people are talking about these emergencies and talking about how synchronized they are. But when you try and look for any actual scientific study of it, you can't find one. And the reason why, you can only find it in one area. And the reason why is that it's only relatively recently, of course, with the emergence of the internet and, you know, walking around with a mobile computer with a mobile phone with access to the internet in your pocket, that we've been able to have, if you like, scientists everywhere at all times. And that's really the beauty of this sort of citizen science approach. I'm really interested in this, but there's no way that I can be all over the country all over the summer recording when they emerge. We absolutely rely on members of the public and schools and everyone else to get involved and to give us the data. And there's so many citizen science projects now that are taking place on so many different aspects of biology, of wildlife, of the environment, that you can find something to get involved with, and you can absolutely be sure that in most cases you're contributing data that is contributing to a study that's never been done before.
And I'd be interested in hearing a bit more about some other citizen science projects in a moment, if we've got time, but how do people get involved then in the Flying Ant Survey? I mean, obviously visit the RSB's website, but what do they actually have to do? Is there a range of ways that they can take part?
Well, this year, to be honest, it's a little bit late now. We've had most of the data in. It would be unusually late to see much emergence. We think it's petering out now. I certainly haven't seen any through the summer. But if people can remember when the flying ants were there, they can get on to the website. They can fill in their details and report it. Another thing that we've encouraged people to do is to print out. There's a little sort of a A4 kind of sign that you can print out that basically says, "I've seen flying ants," and you put in where and when. And you can tweet that, you can use Instagram, Facebook, that sort of thing, to get it onto social media as well, which is interesting for us because we're trying to look at different ways of collecting these sorts of data. For example, it would appear that looking through Twitter and looking at the times and dates that people tweet about flying ants provides almost as reliable data as people filling in surveys, actually, which is quite interesting. So I think as citizen science develops, you know, this is a relatively young field, really, in many respects, particularly making use of technology like the internet and social media. And as it develops, we're going to find a lot more out about how people interact with it and how the best way to get data through to those projects and what the best way is.
So citizen science, then, that'll be a phrase that many people, many teachers will have heard of. Is it as obvious as it sounds, you know, just people getting involved and helping out the science community? Or is it deeper than that? Do people regularly get involved and, you know, end up contributing to a number of projects? And what other projects are out there?
Absolutely. Well, there's loads of projects at the moment. It's a real boom area. There's all sorts of stuff looking at things like tree diseases and emergencies and phenology, the timing of events, the distribution of organisms. There's even some citizen science projects now looking at the behaviour of organisms, getting people to upload photographs of different individual animals, for example, when they go and visit places like the Serengeti and things. I was talking to a guy called Craig Packer who's just starting a study where he's collecting images of lions around different wildlife areas in Africa. So there's all sorts of ways that people can get involved. What's quite interesting is that the scientific community was initially a bit sniffy about this, or a lot of people were, because the notion that the individuals, you know, members of the public, could collect data, it seemed to be completely anathema to them. But what we've shown over the years, over really quite a short period of time, is that people are capable, as a group collectively, of collecting some very, very useful data. And there are ways that you can validate and confirm those data to make sure that they're actually useful. So there's all sorts of projects people can get involved with. From a scientific perspective, from my interest both as a sort of data-driven scientist and also as a science communicator, it's really, really interesting because you can combine engagement with research. So one of the big studies that we did, the Royal Society of Biology, over the last couple of years has been the house spider survey. And we had, I think last year we had something like 50,000 people downloading the app that we made, which allows people to find out a little bit more about the spiders that are in their house, get people a bit more engaged with some of the wildlife that you can see. You know, I'll be honest with you, I don't particularly like seeing house spiders walking across my carpet either, but it helps when you understand a bit more about why they're doing it and why they're there. And we got lots and lots of people engaged with that, but also at the same time, over the course of a year, we got a huge amount of data about when spiders come into people's houses, what species people see, how people engage with citizen science projects, and also sort of when spider season actually lasts. And again, it's something that we've known about for years, but it's very hard to get any real data on it until you've got basically scientists everywhere at all times, and that's the beauty of this sort of approach.
And just finally, Adam, you know, if we're thinking about primary teachers, for example, teaching across the curriculum, what kind of services and resources do the likes of the Royal Society for Biology produce?
Oh, really quite a lot. If you go, but the best thing to do is to go online, go to the Royal Society of Biology's website. There's, I can't remember what the tab's called, but I think it's even called For Teachers, actually. If you go to the Association for the Study of Animal Behaviour, ASAB, they also have lots of resources for teachers. And if you go to the British Ecological Society, any of these sort of more, you know, if you like, learned societies are getting into producing educational materials. And if you're interested in getting involved with citizen science, then a good Google search of citizen science projects will find all sorts. What you'll actually end up finding is far more than you can ever get involved with, and some of them will be out of date. And within the sort of community of citizen science, I think there's a move now to try and have a little bit more of a centralized kind of feel to it so that people can actually go on to, if you like, a hub and sort of get mm-hmm. stuck into particular projects. And I think that'll come over the next few years. You know, you've got to bear in mind that 5 years ago, these big data projects were really just sort of developing, and now what we're seeing is this big ballooning of them. So inevitably, it takes a little bit of time to catch up. But yes, if you visit some of those sites, you'll find all sorts of resources for teachers and schools to get involved.
That's great. Adam, thank you so much for taking time out this evening to join us on Radio EduTalk. Best wishes for the future, and it would be lovely to have you back on the show in the coming months.